I'm going to call taxes to order. It's March 12th. Representative Dorholt, you're first. And I'm going to call the Tax Committee to order and the Property Tax Division to order. This is a joint hearing on some bills that affect both committees. Members, we don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to get going because we have a really full agenda. So we're going to start with Representative Dorholt, and when we have a quorum, we'll move your bill. Okay, so we can't take a motion to that right now. So members, we're on House Bill 1201. Representative Dorholt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With me, since I have Kathy Mihalich from the City of St. Cloud, who can explain the bill until we get a few more members in here.
Thank you. Welcome. Can you say your name again? I didn't quite catch that.
Certainly. Madam Chair, my name is Kathy Mihalich. I'm the Director of Economic Development for the City of St. Cloud. What we have before you today was heard last year in this committee as well, and in both of the tax bills that went forward to the governor. But we are back again because we are one of the collateral damages of the governor's veto on that. And what St. Cloud EDA needs is special legislation to ratify a very old tax increment financing district. It's an old tax increment redevelopment district, and because of the turnover in staff over a period of years in the administration and the evidence we have on record, there's some question about exactly which TIF year district rules apply to this district. There were a lot of changes in the TIF law during this period in the early 80s. And however, the City of St. Cloud has continued to administer and operate this tax increment financing district as what's called a gap year district. And however, because there's still some inconsistency in the files on this, we are requesting the legislature's ratification of this district as a gap year district. That way it provides us some certainty for what to do with the remaining balance of funds in this account and how to treat those funds. To be clear, we are not proposing to extend this tax increment financing district. In fact, it's actually been since decertified, and the bond obligations of which it was committed have since been paid off. Our intentions following the legislative action and approval for the ratification is to return and distribute the remaining balance of roughly $670,000 back to the county for redistribution.
Thank you for your testimony. You. Representative Dorholt, do you have other testifiers?
Not today.
Okay. Is there anyone who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Okay. We do not yet have a quorum, so we can't move and then lay over your bill. But if you trust us, we promise we will. The good thing about this committee is we don't take too many votes. We do a markup of an omnibus tax bill, so we'd just be laying your bill over anyhow. So are members aware of any amendments or anything? Okay. If not, thank you. We appreciate you being here. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Mihalich.
Say okay. The hell, say the itch.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you being here, and as soon as we have a quorum, we'll move it and then lay it over for you.
Thank you so much.
Representative Dill, is he in the room? Representative Dill, welcome. And we can't move your bill yet either, but we will discuss it. So Representative Dill, we have a quorum now? Okay, so Representative Simonson moves House Bill 1201 to be before the committee, which is the bill we just heard, and I will now lay that over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And Representative Lilly now moves House Bill 1169, Representative Dill's bill, to be before the committee. Welcome, and nice to see you, Representative Dill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Chair Lencheski, and this is regarding the tax increment from the City of Ely, and here we have Mr. Landowski here, Councilperson Omerza, and Mr. Fido, a person that worked for them, and Mr. Landowski will explain the dilemma. It's one that you've heard before in other places. Go ahead.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Harold Langowski. I'm the Clerk Treasurer for the City of Ely. The City of Ely is requesting our two existing TIF districts be adjusted to correct the current and anticipated deficits of TIF revenues and TIF number one. TIF number one was for the Grand Ely Lodge infrastructure and is scheduled to end in 2017. The TIF district was established to provide infrastructure to support the construction of the facility. The project has been a success, and the facility is vital to the community for jobs and tourism. The value of the TIF revenue is significantly less than the annual debt payments, resulting in the Ely taxpayers being levied to make up the deficit. An example of this is in 2011, $50,000 was levied, and in 2012, $30,000 was levied. We have also attached a spreadsheet to this document listing the current fund balance in a deficit of $265,000 on this TIF district number one. If we are to continue at our current with our current TIF district, we'll have a deficit in excess of $737,000 by the time it's decertified. TIF district number three was established to install infrastructure to support the Ely Business Park and is scheduled to end in 2026. Located in this business park is the State Department of Revenue building and also St. Louis County Government Services facility that currently was purchased by the county. Prior to this purchase, it was a leased property where they did pay a TIF payment back to this bond debt. We're expecting a loss of approximately $10,240 in 2014 due to this purchase of this property. We're hoping future development in the district will make up for these losses. We currently have all properties in our business district either built on or under contract with the city. The spreadsheet also shows the anticipated fund balance at a positive $478,000 in this TIF district when it decertifies in 2026. We are requesting the revenues from TIF 1 and TIF 3 be pooled to pay the combined debt. We are also requesting that TIF 1 be extended until 2021 from 2017 to pay this remaining debt. Any excess funds will be used to complete future infrastructure maintenance and repairs in this district as allowed by current state statutes. We also provided a resolution from the City Council.
Thank you, Mr. Langowski. Please. Yes, did you want
to? You know, just really quickly to add, we, of course, Heidi Omerza, council member, City of Ely. We, of course, do not want to add any more to the burden of our taxpayers, and as Mr. Langowski did state earlier, we do take from the general fund to compensate for the shortfalls in TIF district number one, and we do have to levy that. So we do not want to continue to do this, so we would appreciate your support on House File 1169.
Thank you for being with us. Further testifiers. Anybody would like to testify for or against this bill? Questions from committee members? Such a quiet group today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Daphne, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I came in late, so, sir, I don't know
Landowski.
Your name or title.
Langowski, I'm the clerk treasurer.
Okay, Mr. Landowski. Can you explain the $478,000 surplus that would be in the account, if I understood your testimony correctly?
Sure. In TIF District number 3, our revenues exceed our debt service. So under the current TIF districts, we're not allowed to pool these funds. So this money would have to remain in that TIF district and be used for future maintenance on that district. Being we have excess funds in 3 and we've got such a large deficit in 1, we'd like to pool these together and make them whole. By the time TIF District number 3 would be decertified, we'd end up almost at a break-even point. We'd have about $45,000 in excess revenues, and again, this is assuming that our TIF payments continue as they are now. Hopefully, we don't have additional property go non-tax. That seems to be what's happened in this TIF district with State Department of Revenue. St. Louis County's building, and actually the city owns a large facility there that we lease out to the state for the Department of Revenue as well. So,
okay. Representative Dabney?
No, that clarification was helpful. Thank you. It's Department of Revenue's fault.
Thank you.
That's the
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question of you, Madam Chair. Is this something that we have done frequently in the past, infrequently in the past, or just occasionally?
Well, it depends who's in charge, but I will ask Mr. Michael to respond to that question. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I guess I would come down on your multiple choice question with the answer occasionally. This is, yes, It says, often requested and occasionally granted.
Representative Erickson, further?
No, Madam Chair, I think that clarifies it.
Okay, thank you. Further questions? If not, we really appreciate you being here, from coming down from Ely, and we're going to lay over House File 1168 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you for being here.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Representative Dowd, are you here? We were trying to squeak Representative Dowd in before the Mayo bill. If we don't, he's probably not going to get it. Okay.
Can I move his bill without him being here, Madam Chair?
You can. And would you like to present it? Does he have another author on that bill?
Sure.
Stephen, do you know? Because we can actually do it for him if you'd like.
Sure, I can.
Are we getting the signal he's rushing down here or he's not coming? Because if he's rushing down here, we could do it. Otherwise, my guess is we won't get to it today.
I can move it, Madam Chair, if he has witnesses here and sit at the table and testify.
You know, this will be to the will. I think that's great, Representative Zellers. And if the committee's okay with this, is everyone okay with this, we can ask Mr. Hines to just walk us through the provisions of the bill. We know we don't vote on it anyhow today. So will Representative Zellers now move House File 1357 for possible inclusion? And this is Mr. Minority Leader. You look a little different today. No, I was talking to you. Oh, here he is. Perfect. We were just giving you the royal treatment there, Representative Dowd. We were going to have Mr. Hines was going to walk through the bill that Representative Zellers just moved for you. So welcome. We have moved House File 1357 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And members, Representative Dowd came and talked to me on the House floor just a few days ago about this coming together. And I said, hurry, get your bill in, and we'll get it on the agenda. So here we are. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your willingness to get me in here quickly, and I apologize about my tardiness. This is a bill basically that would take an organization that's already operating in my area, a fire district right now. It operates as a joint powers board, and it basically would allow them to have taxing authority, so it would make a fire district. The entity right now and the makeup of the entity would basically be the same. They right now each appoint one member, one elected member, to the fire board. And that would continue to be the same under this bill. So, and I believe there are some people here to testify on the bill as well.
Okay, excellent. Testifiers for this bill. Please come down if you're here. Thank you. It's so nice that you were able to attend when your author couldn't be bothered. No, just kidding. Welcome. Nice to see you. Please. If you could just tell us your name for the tape. And
Randy Paulzee, and I stand for district chief.
Thank you.
George Wimmer, I, Sandy Mayor.
Nice to see you. Please, any comments for us? Or
if you want to say anything about it.
Yeah, well, we could give you a little history. What we've done, what the fire district has done, prior to 1998, the fire department was established in 1949. And in 1998, the decision was made by the seven entities that this fire district or this fire group services to become more involved with everything. And so they developed a board to give everybody kind of an equal vote. Everybody has one vote. It's not weighted. Everybody gets an equal vote. And so they developed this district through a joint powers agreement. With this gives everybody the option to approve the budget. The board approves all the budget. They pay the bills. They have their own employees. They do everything that a district does. Except when it comes time to get the money, each individual entity has to go back to their taxpayers, approve the budget through their system, and then basically move that money forward. So it kind of gets to be sort of a mess, especially from the financial end of it, because the money comes from seven different entities all the time, and it gets audited seven times. The fire district itself, by state law, is required to do, through a joint powers agreement, its own audit. So sometimes by the time the checks finally get back to us, the numbers are all wore off because they've been handled so many times. So we'd really like to kind of cut some of the dual services, shall we say, some of the overhead down and have a little more transparency. If a taxpayer right now wanted to know what fire service was costing them in our district, they'd have to go to seven different entities to find out what it's actually costing them in whole. Because they have to audit everybody's books to find out what they're being paid or what they're being charged for. So we're just trying to make this a little easier process make it a little simpler process for the all the people involved that are managing this thing, and you know, just a little more transparency through the whole system.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Mr. was it Wimmer? Did you want to add?
Yep, just a couple things from the city standpoint. Right now, the city is, every year we have to, for the Firefighters Relief Association, the city is solely responsible for that. So when we vote on the benefits, the council is kind of taking a leap of faith that the townships will all pay their portion later, and they have, and that's worked out fairly well. But right now, the city maintains the sole liability, so that's an issue that we're concerned about. This is also, you know, one of those nice things, in Isani County, and when Representative Doubt was a county commissioner, they had worked on a number of things, but we're trying to do pool our services, and this is a nice way to, for, you know, the different localities, city and townships to work together. I think this is a model for other activities as well, everything from public works to policing and that. So being able to have this move forward as an independent district and a taxing district, it's that nice transparency. I'm taxed X dollars, it's going to this very specific service, versus right now for the city, it's funded out of our general fund. We tax you this, it can go to, you know, 30 differing activities. This is a very transparent and I think a really nice look forward the way that government should be funded. So that's really all that I would have to add to Mr. Polzine's testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Faust has a question or comment.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is actually a very good idea, but I'm just a little bit shocked when I read Subdivision 6 that Representative Doubt would actually support somebody increasing taxes. So I don't know if you want to respond to that or not. But
Representative Doubt, former County Commissioner Doubt.
I actually have would suggest a minor technical oral amendment that was brought to my attention by Mr. Hines, and I'm not sure if this is what Representative Faust is referring to, but
if you want to give us the amendment.
Sure. On line 2.8, remove the word real and insert taxable.
Okay, so members, do you see that line 2.8? Oral amendment, Representative Marquardt moves for Representative Doubt. The oral amendment, replace the word real with the word taxable on lines 2.8. Discussion to the motion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Okay, so the oral amendment's adopted. And did you want to comment on Representative Faust?
I certainly can. you know, I think this is actually, and I was pretty involved with this when I was a township officer. We were a customer of the city fire department at that time. We moved this fire department then to a joint powers from a city fire department to a fire department operated by a joint powers board. And this basically, we think, adds a little more transparency so that people can actually see where the tax dollars are going. So we think this will actually be a reduction in taxes, and it'll actually operate a little more efficiently and a little leaner than it did or does currently because of the accounting that's required under the current operation. So, and I have faith in the local, in the city officials and the local township officers. Being a former township officer myself, there's nobody that runs government more efficiently than township officers. So this board is going to be full of township officers to make sure that it's running efficiently and effectively.
Thank you, Mr. Minority Leader. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, when we do these districts like this, or the joint powers agreements, or now the new district, is there a statewide implication? I mean, these are only local issues, right?
Yes, Representative Dabney, I think, is going to sort through what will make it into his division report, and then if it doesn't make it and the full committee wants it to make it, and this is the case with any other bill, they can attempt to amend it. But I think these would just be property tax issues fully contained within the local taxing area. The revenue estimate, if people want to take a look, is a zero. So this is a local thing going on. Did you want to hear from Mr. Hines for further comment?
No, that was just... Okay. The University of Mr. Michael questions.
Oh, well, Mr. Michael, please. Did you want to comment?
That's good enough.
Madam Chair, I think you handled it well.
Well, that's high praise, so thank you. Further questions for Representative Doubt? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair. Is it typical, and I don't know, Representative Doubt, if you know this, that townships would vote the township constituency would get a chance to vote on this collaboration?
Rep. Dowd. And you can phone Mr. Hines behind you.
Tell you maybe I would phone a friend on that one. I'm not sure if the history of these has been that way. I can talk about the operation of how it works now and how it worked in the past, but I don't know about forming these type of entities, and maybe Mr. Hines has an answer to that.
Mr. Hines, do you want to just update the two committees, typically what's on a referendum, what's not on these sort of joint taxing authorities? Mr. Hines.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, the bill does call for each board to vote on whether to join this organization, and then once they did that, they would not be voting on the budget anymore. Their representative on the board would be voting for the levy on the board, but the township itself, that would be its sole decision, is to join or not join.
Thank you. Rep. Sam Erickson, that answers it. Okay, Rep. Sam Carlson, then Earhart. Rep. Sam Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dowd, I'm looking at Subdivision 7 withdrawal, and it's fairly clear, and I understand what you're saying there about if somebody gives the 2 years notice and withdraws, they're still responsible for any debt. But there are still other obligations that are sometimes incurred that wouldn't be classified as debt if one of the cities were to withdraw, or especially if more than one were to withdraw. And I'm not sure how that would be handled. I'm talking now about the operating expenses. You know, you've got a larger entity, and then all of a sudden you've got a smaller entity. And how would that part of it be handled if there were a withdrawal?
Certainly, and I thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. It's in this particular situation, we've got a city with rural townships surrounding it, and the fire department provides services to those rural townships. In basically every case, there's not a fire department that's closer. So if they chose not to be a part of the actual taxing entity, they still would have to probably enter into a contract with them to provide the services, and they would have to pay for those services. So that's exactly how they do it now. So my assumption is that would continue to happen. So they would still actually receive their services from this fire department, even though they may not be part of the taxing district. And then the fire department would, the board or the taxing district would bill that particular township for the services provided. And that township, as part of their levy and their budget, would then pay the fire department for those services.
That handles it, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Sam Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was expecting to hear from Representative Roskowski and maybe Representative Pepin, because we were just in the last hour or so talking about a bill very similar for street assessments that cities can establish, and there's no referendum involved here. You wanted to know if we had a referendum. You know, don't you have some objections to this? Because this is the same damn thing for a different purpose.
Representative Roskowski, you can respond if you want.
I will, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Earhart, I was expecting you to ask those questions. My opinion hasn't changed just because we have a different bill that looks similar to yours.
Okay. Further questions for Representative Dowd or his testifiers? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, Representative Dowd, as I'm understanding this now, so each of the townships has a member on this board, and then the board has taxing authority. So if somebody wants to complain about the tax that's levied, and I heard what you said about how taxes may go down, they may, but if somebody has a complaint then, so how do they get heard with this board that's made up of people who only one of whom actually represents that taxpayer? What's the process for that?
Mr. Paulson, looks like you want to answer.
Yeah, right now we basically have that same thing in process. We have a monthly meeting that this board meets every month. They pay the bills, they listen to all the concerns, they listen to everything that goes on. As far as the tax end of it, we'd be required then to have a tax, the equalization meeting, is that what you call that? The hearing.
Truth and taxation.
Truth and taxation.
There you
Thank
go.
You very much.
Yes.
The truth and taxation hearing, where the people actually get to come and talk to about the budget and so on and so forth. But we do have meetings, monthly meetings now, where citizens do come and are able to And generally, they're asking for more service, not asking for less. But yes, there is a process for that now.
Madam Chair, if I could add on to that, too.
Please,
I mean,
yes.
These are, and thank you, Madam Chair and Representative, these are public meetings, much like a township meeting would be or a city council meeting would be, where the public is welcome to come and discuss concerns about the operation of the fire department as well. So,
Representative,
and that would continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so does every taxpayer who's going to be in one of these townships have an actual representative on this board? So somebody that they actually helped elect is sitting on this board?
Representative Dowd?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Liebling. That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. First being, is your fire department a volunteer fire department, or is it a fully paid fire department?
No, we're a part paid. We're a part paid fire department. We have one full time employee that handles minor medicals during the day and handles the administration work. Our fire department responds to about 700 runs a year, 700 911 calls a year.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as mayor of a community, I've had quite a bit of experience with joint powers agreements and fire departments, and in our particular circumstance, maybe a little unique to yours, is there's always a little bit of a turf battle going on between fire departments, and certainly begs the question whether or not there ought to be consolidation in fire service districts to eliminate some of the duplicity of having three fire chiefs to serve an area, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things that I have noticed is there's, particularly with volunteer fire departments, is oftentimes the pension plans that they have been underfunded, and or there's a movement awry to increase pension funding or increase pension benefits. And it appears to me that at least in the system that we've had, you've got multiple communities that have to weigh in on that, and there's certainly been more pressure to restrain growth in those benefits. And I would just be curious to hear your comments if part of the motivation is to have taxing authority to fund your pension plan.
Who would like to take that? Mr. Wimmer? Mr. Paulson?
Do you want to do it, George?
I'll be right after you.
In our particular case, we're just like every other volunteer pension plan in the state. We've been underfunded since 2008-2007. In our particular situation, and in all the situations when it requires the increase of funds on a pension plan, the city has to verify the increase. In this case, the fire district would have to verify any increase that would go in there. I can speak for my board pretty explicitly on this. There's not going to be any increases. We're still running in a deficit like everybody else in the state on that. I don't think you'll see an increase in that for many, many years, to be quite frank. But it's not at all to increase those benefit funds.
Yeah, I would.
Please.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam.
Sure. Yes, please.
And I would agree with that. I think the overall. One of the main reasons why we're looking at this, because it will cut costs for our taxpayers in this. I speak for our city for sure, and I think Randy does well for the townships there, that there's no inclination to, you know, this is some way to backdoor getting an increase in that I don't think that would be tolerated whatsoever from our voters or from any of the township members. This is a way to try to be more efficient. The city, a number of years ago, because it was a city fire department originally, gave a leap of faith to share. It's basically a power sharing arrangement, so that we're not out there, you know, with the townships kind of at the mercy of whatever we're going to bill them for the services. And Representative Dalt was correct. There's really no other fire department that can provide them the service for this. So this was a really nice model of how local communities work together across that, because we do have those issues of, you know, this turf, that turf, for other items. But this has really come together very nicely for us.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Representative Brunbeck has the question. Representative Brunbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, Dowd, I have a couple of concerns. First of all, the municipalities involved, I don't know what the size of the budget is for the current fire district, but let's say it's $1 million annually, probably not too far off. So those respective cities are going to see a big hole in their budget because they will no longer be funding. So are there plans to reduce the tax rate for the the cities for the their budgeting?
I think we've only got one city right now that's included in this fire district, and Mayor Wimmer obviously is the mayor of that city. Maybe he could more appropriately answer that question.
Please.
Thank you, Chair.
The intention would be, right now, our portion, we pay, I think, what, 35% roughly of the entire district cost, and it's about $140,000, $135,000. It's all based on how many runs there are. So it's right in that range, and the intention would be that we would be lowering that, so again, the overall tax burden would not be increased for our taxpayers. So we're not looking at, okay, well, it's not really a hole. Like, you know, you could have somebody look at it as a surplus. Okay, well, we don't have to make this payment any longer to the fire district, and again, that's not the intention. I don't think that would be tolerated. Our total municipal general fund budget is about $3 million. So $140,000 is a big number in that. And the townships, their number would be very noticeable as well.
Okay. Madam Chair, I mean, I would be happier if you then required the city then to reduce its levy or reduce its budget, you know, commensurately. And also, just a comment, it does appear to be, to me, it's another taxing district. It's another level of government. I think there are better ways to do joint powers, and I would disagree with this. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? If not, we're going to lay this over for Madam possible. I'm so sorry, Representative Roskowski, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I have is on lines 1.10 to 1.12 or 13. Apparently, it appears, at least the way I read it, that this district would have the ability to grow with really out in an unlimited sort of way. Is there a way to limit this language so that it doesn't grow unimpeded?
Mr. Hines or Mr. Michael, is there a way that you could address Representative Draskowski's bill? We won't take that because we know that you're the author who will decide if you're interested in that, but because we're not really marking this up right now. But Mr. Michael or Mr. Hines, is there a way to address? Mr. Hines, if one of you. Mr. Michael, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Draskowski, I think you're correct in describing this process as allowing, essentially adding contiguous units, and then you could add contiguous units to the ones that were added. I think what you could do is restrict it however you wanted to the units in the same county. I don't know if these are all in the same county or not, or to just the ones who are contiguous to the named cities and towns, so that it's just one more layer and not multiple concentric layers of units of government. There'd be a number of different ways that you could do it depending upon how you wanted to do it. If the concern is that this could agglomerate to become, you know, a mega fire protection unit of government.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Thank you. Okay, so I think that's it for questions. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Dowd. Thank you to the testifiers for being here.
Thank you, Madam.
And as we move to Representative Norton, I'll just say, members, we'll all recall Representative Dowd, like every single one of us here. We carry bills for our local communities. We don't always agree with every provision in them. And so that's part of our due diligence here. And it's really this committee will have to decide which part of all of these bills we've been hearing we like and which ones we don't. But we will, that applies to every bill we've heard today, and now there's another. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes, please, Representative Brunbeck.
Just wanted to clarify what you're saying. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, part of the representative's duty is maybe to judge whether it's a good bill and whether it's not. I hope you're not saying we're just automatically expected to carry whatever bills our local governments bring to us.
No, what I'm saying is, and you may be an exception, Representative Runbeck, but I think most of us, at least the freshmen, I don't know exactly, but everybody else I can think of in this room almost has carried a bill that they did not like every single provision in it. And out of a courtesy to their community, they've carried it. That doesn't mean this tax committee will take it or not take it, and they may change it or not. So there are certainly folks who refuse, and I've been one who have refused to carry a number of bills in my community, but I think over the course of the time we've been here, we've all carried bills that we may not like every nuance, and we heard Representative Dowd, and I think he'll work on some of the things he heard, is my guess, from the committee. So with that, Representative Liebling moves House File 409 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and we're delighted to have you here, Representative Norton, and I'm sure you have a number of testifiers, and please kick it off. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'm going to give a brief overview, and then we do have a number of testifiers that hopefully we'll be able to get to today, and then I'm sure you'll have lots of questions, and we'd be happy to answer those for you. So House File 409, the Destination Medical Center Initiative, provides Minnesota with a major economic development opportunity that will deliver significant benefits, stimulating billions of dollars in private investment, thousands of new jobs in the state of Minnesota, and billions of dollars in new tax revenue to the state. Mayo Clinic is currently a world leader in healthcare, the largest private employer in the state of Minnesota, and provides billions of dollars in economic impact in our state's economy. Mayo's position as a global medical destination is a reality, but sustaining that is not a given. We should not take that for granted. Without continued growth and innovation, without private investment, and without public infrastructure necessary to support this growth, Mayo Clinic and Minnesota will lose their competitive position as a global medical destination. Before you today is a plan to secure Rochester and the state of Minnesota as a medical destination for patients throughout the country and the world into the future, and it will drive significant economic and job growth over the next 20 years. I'm going to share a few of the aspects of that plan today and then let some speakers come before you to talk about specifics. Plans for Mayo Clinic to invest in excess of $3 billion of Mayo's private capital in Minnesota to expand the needed buildings, facilities, and programs throughout Minnesota. There will be $2 billion in additional private investments to support patient and visitors, employees, community members, as there is a growing demand for lodging, housing, retail, hospitality, recreation, and other enhancements that a strong community would have. Approximately 25,000 to 30,000 new direct jobs will be created with this proposal, and that'll be over 20 years. Estimates are for a creation of about 1,800 to 2,200 construction jobs per year as this Mayo Clinic Destination Medical Center grows out and our community invests in infrastructure. Hundreds of thousands of new patients and visitors will travel to Minnesota and Rochester every year. Approximately $3 billion in new tax revenues will be generated to the state and local governments. And Mayo Clinic will aggressively work to retain in Minnesota the new businesses that emerge from Mayo Clinic's extensive medical research, which I think is a positive for us all. The Destination Medical Center public financing component outlined in this legislation is an innovative finance plan with a $10 to $1 ratio of private to public investment, as well as a guarantee that no public financing will be provided without proof that tax revenues have actually been generated by the state to the state by Mayo Clinic and the DMC expansion. The $585 million proposed public investment will be made over 20 years, and it will be in public infrastructure and improvements that support the growth of employment, visitation, and spending in the market. Please note that none of the dollars will go to Mayo Clinic. Mayo will invest in its own growth and infrastructure. These dollars are invested in the Rochester community to support infrastructure. This 20-year multi-billion dollar Destination Medical Center plan represents one of the largest economic development initiatives in the country and will deliver significant benefits to Minnesota, including thousands of new jobs and billions in new tax revenue. The proposal before you enjoys bipartisan support and support from business, labor, and many other in this room behind me today. This is a significant opportunity for Minnesota, but we need your help to make it a reality. And with that, we do have a number of testifiers. And I don't know
Please.
If you would like, okay.
Whoever you'd like.
Sure. Dr. Narr.
Welcome.
Randy Staver, maybe both.
And Representative Norton, we'll let you pick the order of who you would like to speak. So.
Well, we'll have Dr. Narr go first.
Okay, please, welcome.
Thank you very much. Madam Chairman, my name is Brad Narr. I'm a lifetime Minnesotan. I'm a product of the University of Minnesota. Both undergraduate and medical school, I've practiced in Rochester for approximately 33 years. We have a unique practice. It's very, very big. We see 350,000 unique patients per year. What's unique about it is it's in a very small community. Rochester is approximately 100,000 people. And those things bring about certain issues that other others of our competitors don't have to face. Cleveland is in, the Cleveland Clinic is in Cleveland. Johns Hopkins Medical Center is in Baltimore. MD Anderson is in a big city in Texas. Mass General is in Boston. These cities are on the same order of magnitude and population as our entire state. That's why we're here before the state. How big and what is unique about the Mayo Clinic practice? We have the largest adult congenital heart practice in the world. We do more esophagectomies than any other practice in North America. We will complete our 500th robotic mitral valve surgery this month. We're the largest contributor to the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program database, which is the best risk-adjusted outcome database in the country. We're trying to prove our value to the nation and to the world for coming to the Mayo Clinic. In addition, we had 2,000 patients from Canada last year. It's an interventional practice. And when you do things a lot, you get really good at it. Intentional practice. It's the practice of medicine. I'm sure some of you have heard about our recent projects. The heavy proton beam is a new mechanism for radiation therapy for mostly kids because of the way the energy is released in different tumors. We have three major initiatives over the last 2 years and the next 3 years in the science of healthcare delivery, individualized medicine, and knowledge management. These have caused us to add approximately 2,400 people to our staff. The way we work is we save, we invest, we hire, and then we digest those things into our practice. Right now, the thing we're looking for help for is to make sure that we can create the optimal experience for patients, visitors, and community. We want to be seen as the global destination for healthcare in the world. We believe we have an 80-year head start. We're an integrated practice. All of our physicians are salaried. We try and get the best opinion for the complex medical disorders as a collusion of forces moving it forward. And if any of you have been to the Mayo Clinic and had any complex care, it's not my wish for any of you. The things we're best at, we don't want anybody to get. But it's very, very obvious, and we feel we have an 80-year head start on our competition because of this integrated practice. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Narr. Appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Randy Staver. I'm the current president of the Rochester City Council. Thank you for the opportunity to present here today. The City of Rochester and the community are enthusiastic and support the DMC and will be supporting the DMC financially. Approximately $60 million of the proposed $585 million in public costs will be financed locally through an extension of the Rochester City sales tax and employing other local financing tools such as revenue bonding, tax abatement, and tax increment financing. We've already got skin in the game. In November, Rochester voters approved on a 2-to-1 margin approximately $20 million in city sales tax revenue specifically to support DMC. However, the proposed growth caused by the level of private investment by Mayo Clinic and others will require a level of public infrastructure that is beyond what the City of Rochester can handle alone and that the private sector will not fund. All business, job, and population growth requires public infrastructure to support the growth, whether it occurs in Rochester, the Twin Cities, or in other states. Locally, the growth and economic impact offered by the DMC will benefit not just Rochester, but also our surrounding communities and the region as a whole. We've got a strong coalition of community organizations, local government, businesses, and others who are committed to the DMC and to the successful passage of this finance plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Staver. Sam Norton, others?
We have a few others.
We will. Why don't we just get through everybody? I think Representative Norton has a list. I know lots of people have questions. I can see everyone kind of waving. So we'd like to get through all the testimony. We can call anyone back that someone has a question for. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Shay Mandel, and I represent Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley is the largest state-based life sciences organization in the country. Reflecting Minnesota's great strength in this area. We have nearly 700 companies and organizations that are part of Life Science Alley, and our companies and organizations employ more than 250,000 Minnesotans. We're here in support of this plan because we think this is about Minnesota's future. The Mayo Clinic continues to be the gold standard. It is a global asset for healthcare, for treatment, and for research. And the question isn't so much whether Mayo is going to figure out the best way to serve the world's population, but from where it's going to do it. So you heard about great competition and Mass General and the Cleveland Clinic, and these are just U.S. competitors, are investing heavily in doing so with a lot of public resources to attempt to unseat Mayo. And today, our global patient population looks for an experience that allows them, when they come and receive the highest health care, to spend a month or spend 2 weeks, to engage in our community. And it's really important that Rochester has the opportunity to continue to be a global medical destination. But besides how this plays out for the state, how Mayo continues to serve its patient population, besides the jobs that Mayo has outlined in construction and in terms of research, there's also another impact that's really critical to our corporations and our organizations, and that is the continued influence of Minnesota as a leader in research and in entrepreneurship. We work a lot with Mayo to really look at commercializing and translating the technologies and research that are developed there to create new companies in our state. And the more activity there is around that, the more opportunity there is for us to bring venture capital money to the state. I know most of you watch the numbers and see we continue to see slides in that area. And with this plan on the table, you know, we've started to get some interest from venture capital firms that want to see what happens in Minnesota and are interested in investing in early stage companies. In addition, our companies work with Mayo on a host of things to get their products to market, from clinical trial work to working with physicians around the technologies that we develop. So Mayo is a critical asset, not just for the care of our people, but for the future of our economy. And so on behalf of Life Science Alley, and again, all of our companies that really represent the most contiguous life science community in the country, we really urge the state to take advantage of this unique and innovative once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to ensure that Mayo and Rochester grow and we continue to lead the world in this healthcare. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Further, others. Representative Norton, who would you like next?
I have Harry Melander and Beth Cadoon.
Mr. Melander. I don't see him.
Well, Harry's not here.
We'll go to Ms. Cadoon or whoever you'd like. Welcome.
Ms. Chair, and for a second. My name's Russell Hess, and members of the committee. Harry Melander's not able to make it, so I'm going to fill in for the building trades. My name is Russell Hess. I work for the Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota, and I live in the greater surrounding Rochester area, actually Plainview, Minnesota. So each day I get to try to beat the bus that hauls people from Plainview and other points north and east to Rochester to work at the clinic. I try to beat that out of town so I can get here a little bit faster, still legally. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 409, more popularly known as the Destination Medical Center proposed in Rochester, Minnesota. The Mayo Clinic and Building Trades have a long history of partnering to build Mayo, Rochester, and really all of southeast Minnesota into what it is today. In fact, as we speak, our members are working on three major projects at the clinics in Rochester, accounting for over 1 million work hours, and just a rough estimate, that comes to around $30 million of wages just on those projects alone. Our members are eager to get going on the next phase of that partnership, the Destination Medical Center. At our my last union meeting, as we were discussing the DMC proposal, and there was a lot of discussion about what Mayo's doing and when they're doing it at our union meetings, I was struck by two different perspectives on this project. Our older and retired members wanted to talk about the projects that they had built over the years and how those projects formed the basis of careers that supported their families and their careers. And when I say careers, I mean careers. Our union just had our annual holiday party, and we passed out pins to several members recognizing them for 45 years of membership, up to 55 years of membership. And unfortunately, we just had a member pass away who had 65 years of membership in our union, lots and lots and lots of hours working at the Mayo Clinic, building that into what it is today. These are good jobs with health insurance, pensions that build strong families, and a strong middle class. The other side of this coin is our younger members and apprentices who are working hard to perfect their crafts, who see this project as more than just another building and more than just infrastructure in town. For them, it's a future of steady work, so that they can provide for their families, like building Mayo and Rochester has been for their fathers and grandfathers. With the estimated 1,800 to 2,200 construction jobs each year from DMC, this is an investment in Minnesota that will pay dividends for years and years to come. In closing, our members are ready and eager to go, building projects for the next 20 years that will contribute to our state being recognized as a global leader and one that invests in smart economic developments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Welcome, Ms. Cadoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Beth Cadoon, and I'm representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. It's always nice to see when we can have unions and business speaking in favor of the bill, and this is certainly one of them. We believe we're strongly supportive of House File 409, and thank Representative Norton for bringing this forward, as well as the Mayo. The Mayo is truly a unique state asset, as well as the largest private sector employer in the state. And Minnesota, as was mentioned, has been instrumental in establishing Minnesota as a leader in health care throughout the nation and the world. We believe the economic impact of Mayo and this proposal will certainly be felt statewide. Some of the key parts of the plan that the Chamber believes makes it a unique opportunity for the state is, one, the significant private investment, what Representative Norton talked about, that will be occurring, that this private investment is occurring prior to the public infrastructure dollars being spent, and that there's proof of those private dollars and the tax revenue that's coming from it. That's critical. And that the public infrastructure dollars are generated and easily identified by the new private investment, and this does not result in a tax increase to fund this public portion. We all have the common goal of growing jobs and strengthening Minnesota's job climate now and in the future. House File 409 is a tremendous opportunity for Minnesota with the creation of 35,000 to 45,000 jobs, both direct and indirect, and continuing and strengthening Minnesota as a premier national and international destination for health care. So thank you for your kind consideration and support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Representative Norton, who else?
We do have Bob Dunn, who is going to do a little PowerPoint presentation and fill you in on some details, and then we can take questions.
Okay,
and we have some amendments after.
Okay, please, Mr. Dunn. Robin. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bob Dunn. I'm president of the Hammes Company. Our firm has been the lead consultant with the Mayo Clinic on the DMC project now for the last 3 years. What I'm going to do is walk through some of the key points that Representative Norton and Dr. Narr touched on that get at the essence of some of the questions that we've heard from your committee as well as some of the others. And I think the most important point as we get into some of the detail is there's really two elements of this proposal that are very unique. Number one, this is not about picking an industry and picking winners and losers within this industry. The Mayo Clinic is a very unique institution that brings a significant amount of spending and the potential for growth to the state of Minnesota. And what this proposal really is, at its essence, is a proposal about economic development. And we're seeing numbers and the potential to capture economic development here in Minnesota, frankly, unlike any proposal like this that we've seen throughout the country. When you look at the numbers, as you see on the screen here, upwards of 30,000 new direct jobs. In this economy, in this country, that is a significant amount of job growth generated by one employer, almost unheard of in this country today. The second key point that I would point that I would identify for you is this whole proposal is driven by greater than $5 billion of private investment. Normally, with an economic development proposal anywhere near this magnitude, you would have a sharing of the cost right up front. You've seen it here in Minnesota. We see it all over the country. Generally, when these proposals are made, the public dollars are invested at the front end, day one, sometimes alongside private dollars, oftentimes without any investment of private money. In this case, the private dollars are the first dollars in, and they drive the whole economic model. The third bullet identifies really the gain to the state of Minnesota. Over the time horizon that we've run the forecast, 20 to 35 years, the state of Minnesota will realize growth in taxes of more than $8 billion. Again, I've yet to see a proposal in the world of economic development that generates that much of a fiscal gain to a state and to a community as we're seeing with this proposal. The second key point that I would make is you have the ability to control the outcome of this proposal. Oftentimes when economic development proposals are brought forward, they're brought forward in a competitive manner where communities are vying against one another to secure an opportunity like this. You alone have the ability to control the outcome of this proposal and drive this economic development plan forward for the state of Minnesota, which will impact the state for generations to come. And this diagram, I think, kind of gets at the essence of how we've looked to structure the proposal. The concept here, unlike what I said a minute ago, where normally the public dollars are coming in first, the proposal here is that Mayo investment drives the whole economic model. With the investment of more than $3 billion by Mayo to support growth of the medical center, which you'll see in a minute, that drives growth of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs. The job growth is what drives the increase in taxes, and only when the state has realized and secured new taxes do we have the ability to use a small portion of that new tax base to fund infrastructure, which then supports additional private investment. So in effect, what we're doing is reversing the trend of how these things are normally done. We think that's a very unique opportunity for the state of Minnesota. The next couple of points that I would call to your attention are just some of the core facts about this plan. You have an opportunity here to build an economic development plan around one of the strongest and most stable industries in our country today, healthcare. And not only are you building in a strong industry, but you're doing it with the worldwide leader. Again, oftentimes with these economic development proposals, you could go almost state to state today, and nearly every state in our country is looking to build its economic core off industries like the biosciences. But much of that industry is untested, unproven, with corporations that didn't exist as recently as a year or two or four or 5 years ago. Here you have an institution that's recognized worldwide as the leader, which has been based in this state for over 100 years. It would be hard to find an institution that you could build a partnership with stronger than the Mayo Clinic. The other point that I would make, which Representative Norton made earlier, is this is not a plan that drives public dollars to the Mayo Clinic. This is a plan that supports the growth of the Mayo Clinic and builds the necessary infrastructure that is needed for that growth to occur here in Minnesota. And there's some good examples that I think you could point at in this state where you've done this before. Perfect example is here in the Twin Cities, your airport. You've seen growth in the volume of visitation through your airport of millions of visits a year. In order to support that growth, you have had to greatly expand the airport infrastructure, the terminals, the runways, the parking facilities. Everything that exists in the airport had to be expanded to accommodate the growth. We use the same measure in Rochester with Mayo. Today we see roughly 7.5 million visits a year coming to Rochester, almost all of which are driven by the Mayo Clinic. With the growth that we'll see in Rochester with the Mayo Clinic, that number, annual visitation, will grow to 12 to 13 million annual visits, nearly double what occurs there today. In order to support that amount of growth in a community, frankly, that is not able to support that level of visitation, infrastructure has to expand. And you'll see in a minute how we define infrastructure. It's everything you can imagine, from roads, streets, parking, site, a full spectrum of costs that represent urban infrastructure in order to support a doubling of the annual volume of patrons that come to the city. You can't grow an institution like Mayo and not have the infrastructure to support it, no different than your airport. I'll touch on this for just a minute. This is a pretty simple slide, but it gets at almost 2 years of research that we've done with the Mayo Clinic. And basically what this slide communicates is what has been the driving force of the whole DMC concept. Today, among the people that come to the Mayo Clinic, the response of the care and the quality of care that's provided by Mayo has never been higher. That's been tested very carefully. What we have also learned is that upwards of 80% of the time that is spent by a patient coming to Rochester for a clinical visit at Mayo, 80% of that time is spent outside of the clinic. And the satisfaction level for the 80% of the time that is spent in Rochester is at a very low level. So two things are happening in Rochester today as a result of that. It is becoming very difficult to recruit to Rochester. Dr. Narr can speak to that far better than I can, but it's one of the great challenges of growing the medical center is the ability to continue to attract and retain the most competent staff that allows Mayo to retain its position as the number one leader in healthcare. The second issue that we have is healthcare today is very different than it was 20 years ago. The notion of coming to a destination medical center is no longer just about going there for the highest quality of care. There are competitors around the world today that did not exist 5, 10, and certainly not 20 years ago. Mayo Clinic competes with these institutions every day. In order to maintain their position as the number one leader in healthcare, they have to grow to the tune of a $3 billion investment, and they have to become more of a destination to support their model and their practice. And when we talk about the Mayo Clinic is very different than its peers in its industry. What the map shows you is what has emerged essentially in the last 5 years in healthcare. The competing institutions to Mayo, the Cleveland Clinic, MD Anderson, Johns Hopkins, all nearly every one of those institutions is branching out worldwide. Their focus is to go where the patient is. Mayo's focus is very different. And this is an important point that we all need to understand. Mayo's focus is an integrated model. It's concentrating all of its specialties in one location and bringing the patient to that destination, recognizing that 80% of their time is spent outside the four walls of the Mayo Clinic. To be successful practicing the way that Mayo intends to practice in the future, we have to hit on all cylinders when it comes to bringing people from around the world to Rochester and providing them not just with the highest quality of care, but providing them with a world-class destination here in Minnesota. And there's many factors that place that at risk, many of which we would all understand, everything from travel, weather, where do I stay, the cost of getting there, any number of factors that today, I would argue, Rochester does not present itself as a world-class destination the way that it will need to in the future to support Mayo's mission. This we'll come back and talk about, I'm sure, in some detail, but one of the things
that
you...
I'm sorry, you know, Representative Norton, we don't have any of this. All we're doing is looking up there. So it'd be great if later we could get all this information in front of the members.
Absolutely.
Please, Mr. Dunn, go right ahead.
I apologize.
It's just, it's hard for...
This is going to be
now
hard
that we're
to
at
read.
This one, I think it's going to be hard to read. So, please.
Let me do my best to explain what's on the chart in front of you. Probably the most significant question that we've had over the last several months as we've unveiled this proposal is, where will the dollars be spent? And the paralleling question that we get to that is, why can't we do what we do in other communities that need to build infrastructure, which is to support that need locally? Those are very important questions, and what this graphic is attempting to do is to give you an answer to that. What this shows is a breakdown based on a 20-year forecast of the total infrastructure that will be needed in Rochester to support the level of growth that is projected with Mayo's investment, as I said, of over $3 billion just in the medical center. So what these columns represent are the city of Rochester will continue to fund its normal capital investment in infrastructure. So the first column that you see shows the city of Rochester over 20 years investing $339 million in its core infrastructure downtown. The reason that's important is today the city of Rochester spends $525 per capita on capital investment in the city, very high in Minnesota, among the highest dollars spent per capita of any community in the state of Minnesota. So Rochester is already spending at the high end of the scale of where communities are investing in capital investment. In addition to that, when you add in the $585 million, which is broken down into all the rows here, all the categories of cost, it's broken down into transportation, transit, public utilities, public spaces, parcel development, parking, civic, cultural, and historic investment. The type of urban infrastructure that needs to be developed in Rochester to support Mayo's growth. So the $585 million we refer to as extraordinary cost. Things over and above the $339 million that the city is already forecasted to spend going forward in building normal city infrastructure. The challenge that we face is if you said, put the burden of $585 million of additional infrastructure burden on the city of Rochester, you would roughly take what is today a $525 per capita investment every year, and you would grow that to almost $1,600 a year, all on the shoulders of the city of Rochester, which would be an overwhelming burden to place on one community the size of Rochester. So it's a scale problem. You know, if Mayo were building its infrastructure here in the Twin Cities, you have an urban infrastructure here that could probably support it very differently. But in Rochester, where you have a population of 107,000 people and a certain volume of tax base to support a $585 million investment in infrastructure, you will break the bank very quickly, given the needs for infrastructure to be built out over 20 years. And the last slide that I'll touch on gets at what we believe is the strength of the proposal that's been made to the state of Minnesota. What this graphic represents is the fiscal structure of the DMC plan. What I mean by that is the blue line represents the growth in taxes to the state over the forecast period, which is 35 years. So the growth in taxes totals $8.2 billion over that 35-year period of time, and those taxes are made up of personal income tax, sales and use tax, corporate franchise tax, and property tax. So given this new investment, the state of Minnesota is seeing $8.2 billion of new taxes, new incremental taxes, most of which are generated by people that reside outside of the state of Minnesota. You're bringing new spending and new taxes to the state of Minnesota. This is not redistribution of taxes within the state of Minnesota. These are new tax dollars, almost all of which are generated by non-residents of the state of Minnesota. The flip side of that argument is there's a cost to secure that $8 billion of tax growth. The cost is what is represented by the red line. The red line shows a building up over time of the $585 million of cost and amortizing that the same way you would amortize any other bond financing in the state of Minnesota over a 35-year period. Again, remember that those dollars do not come in until such time as we've proven growth in state taxes. In other words, you've received the new tax dollars before a dime is spent building infrastructure. So in effect, you've got a guarantee of new revenues to support the capital investment. The other lines that are shown here, the green line is what we call our debt coverage line. The way the bill has been structured, we wanted to have a mechanism that provided you a measure of security, and that's what the green line represents, that there's a forecast of no dollars can be drawn in until you're generating a minimum of 1.5 times the amount of money that's needed to amortize the debt. In other words, if we needed $10 million to build the first phase of infrastructure, you have to be receiving $15 million at a minimum before we can draw any of that debt down, before we can invest anything in public infrastructure. And the last point I'll make is the black line. One of the questions that we get just about every day is, won't this growth already occur? Won't we capture this growth in tax base anyways? And so we wanted to have a means of showing you what the forecast is if Mayo did not make this investment here in Minnesota. If Mayo did not make its investment here in Minnesota to build the destination practice, you would still see growth. The Mayo Clinic's not leaving the state of Minnesota. you would still see some amount of what we would call normal growth within the medical center. What you would not see is the tens of thousands of jobs, nor the multi-billion dollar growth in tax base, but you would see some growth in the medical center. Because as I said, the Mayo Clinic can't pick up and leave Minnesota. That's never been the proposal here. But the growth, the incremental strength that can be brought to the state of Minnesota would not be captured. So the difference between the black line and the blue line, the black line is sort of status quo. If Mayo just continued to run its operation, there would still be a modest level of growth that would occur in Rochester from which you would derive some benefit. But if Mayo cedes its capital investment of north of $3 billion here, which translates to tens of thousands of new jobs, you realize the blue line. So the proposal here is for an investment of $585 million of public money into the community infrastructure, you're getting a nearly tenfold return in terms of new tax dollars, which in the world of economic development, in most cases, that relationship, at best, in most cases, is one-to-one. With most of these proposals, normally what you see is if $100 million of public investment is made, you hope to realize $100 million of fiscal impact. And that's generally based on a forecast. This proposal, we believe, is considerably stronger than that. There is no forecasting. You have no public investment unless you are realizing and receiving the growth in taxes needed to support the public investment. So with that, we'll conclude and answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Norton, did you have anyone else?
We have some folks here that could help answer some questions.
It's up to you. We have a lot of questions from members on the list, but we want you to finish your presentation before we start questions.
I think that's, we'll just conclude there, and I think probably get to your questions would be the best way to handle
okay.
it.
And we can always bring people up who you need. First on the list, Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and Representative Norton, thank you for bringing this exciting project forward. And I think we would like to see this work, and I really like to hear the 30 or 40,000 new jobs in the future, and we're going to work really hard to make sure they're all trained workforce by that time, too, so we're going to work real hard at that. One question I had when I was kind of looking through this, and it was alluded to a little bit, was the commitment or the amount that the city of Rochester was putting in. I know on page 19.22 to 19.25 in the bill, it mentions the $60 million by the city of Rochester. And it looked like whatever they would grant or bond or whatever would be taken off or minused off the 585 debt. And I, on the next page, on page 20, it talks about the city of Rochester may, it may. I'd feel more comfortable because a lot of times when we do these local bonding, there's a specific local commitment. And so, I don't know, I'd like to see, is there a commitment? Is it for sure there will be? And I know, I heard there's been, you know, a sales tax, $20 million going towards this. But is the city of Rochester committed to spend this $60 million? Or what is the actual commitment by the city of Rochester?
Representative Norton, I think the question's to your city council. Or
yes, and I will just say up front that it was explained that we did have the vote in our community up front that it was explained that we did have the vote in our community, and $20 million of that is already designated. It has been voted on by the community, and you will see that has been subtracted from the fiscal note. So that 20 has already been subtracted, and the fiscal note was based on 565. And then if you'd like to hear from the city directly, we'll bring
Council member
Staver back up.
Mr. Staver, as you come down, we have you down as both a council member and a Mayo employee. Which one are you?
I'm here today representing the city of Rochester, city council president.
So you're not, you don't work for Mayo?
I do work for Mayo Clinic.
Oh, okay.
True.
Please, Mr. Staver.
All right.
Or council member Staver.
And could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, very good. Madam Chair, the question is on the $60 million that's in the bill, that if the city spends would be subtracted off the 585 that what is the City of Rochester committed to do, and all the language is a may instead of a shall. And I'm wondering how the city feels about that, or what would be the commitment?
Councilmember Staver, please.
Yes, absolutely. We look to stand as partners in this proposal. The additional monies that we're talking about are the additional normal capital improvement that we would look to expend over the ensuing years. As any city does, we reserve funds for capital improvement for roads and wastewater treatment and those sorts of things. So we would certainly expect to commit additional dollars as we go forward in the ensuing couple of decades.
Representative Markford.
Madam Chair, I mean, council member, would you be amenable to putting that the city shall do the $60 million? Because, I mean, of course, that has a stake on the final number from the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in there, but it's a may rather than a shall.
Right.
Councilmember Staver, can you pass that vote on your city council? Are you all in for 60, like the bill's being presented?
Well, what I can say is that the city council has been in unanimous support to date on this proposal and moving forward in lockstep. So we will certainly take that in under consideration. Absolutely.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
Just one more question on that point is, and what would those expenses go towards? I mean, as far as the city portion, whether or not it's whatever it would be, what would that go towards?
Yes, largely the infrastructure things such as roads, some land acquisition, public space, amenities, things that enliven the city of Rochester for all of our visitors and community members. So this is totally apart from any of the dollars that are being invested by Mayo Clinic on their part.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
And just on that, why is the $60 million number in there on line 19.25?
Councilmember Staver or Representative Norton? Or
I guess it's kind of the council member. I mean, if there's no guarantee to spend the $60 million, why is that $60 million there?
That was a number that was derived based on what we thought the expenditures would be needed to fund the sorts of infrastructure and amenities that we're hoping to build in support of the larger project.
Representative Markford?
Yeah, just one more question. And it has to do with the appropriation bonds because, let's see, the pay for the Rochester Area Medical Center Development Authority would issue these bonds. And maybe this is a question more for Mr. Michael, but how does that impact future ability, since this would be state obligation, state dollars that would be diverted to pay for this? Does that impact the state's ability to do capital investments in the future? Just how does that work out?
I'm just Mr. wondering. Michael, and I should say, members, there is a big bonding provision in this bill, as we all can see here, and so our intent would be to send those provisions to the Capital Investment Committee. But Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Markford, I think that's more a question that properly should be addressed to the folks at MMB who make judgments about whether this would count against the state's credit. It's not something that my opinion would not be worth much on it.
Is MMB here? Is there anybody here from MMB who can answer Representative Markford's question? Okay, well, we can get that. Looks like we'll run out of time. We'll have to come back so we can get the question in the
and
next
Madam
meeting.
Chair, I can't
Representative Norton, please.
Yeah, I have had a sit down with Kristen from MMB, and this appropriation would count against the Rule 2, which the bonding committee has to has Rule 1 and Rule 2. So it would count against the 6% limit and fits within there. The question I think that we still need to discuss with the chair of the bonding committee is, as the money rolls off of something that might be spent to something that will be spent, then it will count against Rule 1, and as any bonding bill does. Once it's appropriated, it does affect it, and as you can see in here, the bill does state no more than 75 at a time can be shifted over in a one-year period, and that would count against whatever amount that bonding capacity, that would count against Rule 1. And so we are still working through that with the committee and the bonding capital investment committee, and we will discuss it further.
So, Madam Chair, just one final comment.
Yes.
So, Representative Norton, this is a great project, and I just want to make sure it works. You know, we just went through a last session, you know, a big project, and I want to make sure the financing and all that works. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Norton, I have a question for you. Are any of your testifiers, and then we have Loeffler, I guess the next three after me are Loeffler, Dabney, Earhart, and as I've said, we are going to clearly have to come back because we have more people than that, and we have people who want to testify. But, you know, just to put it out there, Representative Norton, I know people have, you know, asked me, both sides of the aisle here and people in the building, kind of, what's your objection? And so I think I should just put it on the record so that we can talk about it. And since we're going to have to come back, because we're not going to get this bill done in 8 minutes, we can talk about it further, and you can provide information. And so, you know, there may be some misunderstanding between what the bill actually says and how it's being, you know, told to members and how it was just presented right here and now. And I read the bill very differently. If folks want to later correct me that somehow I'm misunderstanding this bill, that's fine, and I'd ask Mr. Michael to correct me as well, who spends his time reading these bills. But here's an issue that I think we just have to put out there, and everybody has to talk about this, because people have been waiting for your bill to get to taxes in both bodies. And so that's what we are about here. This is a massive public subsidy from the taxpayers to this developer, and I know it's being presented that it's not really for Mayo, it's for the city, but it's the Mayo development that is driving the city's request. So, you know, and I think, you know, we understand that. I mean, you're not, you know, we know that. It wouldn't be here if that's not what it was. And so the question is, you know, is this a public subsidy that's worth it for our taxpayers and for all of Minnesota? And the issue I'm having really with this is that the details of the bill, to me, read that the taxing mechanism, the financing mechanism, not only are they precedent setting that have never been done in Minnesota, and I would strongly urge my colleagues never to do them, and think about other ways to get where people want to go. The state has never done this. This is a unique item. It's allowing one developer to carve off the income and sales tax that's in the city of Rochester for their benefit. And what does that mean? It's a tax increase for everybody else to make up for that loss. So some of the concerns I have in the bill very specifically is the bill uses a 2011 baseline for generating the revenue that it's presenting to all of us. And if we can all just think about that for, you know, what happened in 2011? And what is the growth likely after 2011? You know, it's sort of picking the bottom of the trough over a 20-year window of baseline taxes paid, coming out at the bottom of the recession, and we'll see this growth that every company is experiencing and capturing that growth. If you back out the timeline and look at a 20-year base, there's no exceptional growth here. There's no excess revenue here, members. This is not, in my opinion, with all due respect, this is not no public financing without proof that people have said. It is a public subsidy from Minnesotans on the very first dollar. That is how this bill reads. It is not, you know, only after everyone's put all this on is the taxpayer going to come in. So the way it works is it counts a 2011 base and says, for every dollar growing out of for tax revenue, the project captures two-thirds of the very first dollar, 60% of the first dollar. So, you know, I know people aren't hearing it that way, but, I have to put it out there, members, because the rhetoric supporting the bill says we're only going to get this if there's extraordinary growth. So I will pass out to Representative Norton and Representative Liebling and to anyone who wants it, a request I made of House Research nonpartisan staff to apply this bill to what's been going on for 20 years in Rochester. And so in looking backward in the tax growth, and I had asked for, you know, information about this privately, that's been happening in the Rochester and Olmsted County area, and we can hand that out. I think the pages have it if people want to pass it out. You know, this developer, this business, has not grown any faster than any other business in Minnesota. And it's more lightly taxed, members. This is the tax committee. This Mayo is more lightly taxed than other large employers. We tax the health industry less. The multinationals certainly pay higher rates of taxation, and I think if we would ask folks to tell us what taxes they pay in the corporate tax, income tax, and others right now in Mayo, in current law, I think members would be surprised. So we have a lot of preferences in the tax code already for health. But what this is doing, you know, is trying to say, look, just let us have the growth. And so I just want to be clear as members think about this because, you know, it's March. We have a lot of time to work on this. So you're trucking along, you fall into a recession, and as you come out of the recession, the bill picks the bottom of the pit, the bottom of the ravine, and sort of ignores what's been going on for 20 years. And so I asked House Research to apply this for 20 years looking back, and the data was pretty clear that, you know, this has not paid, folks have not been putting in extra here compared to most businesses. And I took the bill and asked that it be applied to, what if this were the law? What would have happened if this bill were the law? And it would have generated $40 million over 20 years. So, you know, I want to have it out here so Representative Norton and her team can respond to it before we come back and get more information. And I want to have Representative Norton respond right now. But, I have many, many concerns beyond that. I do want Mr. Michael to just quickly reference what I asked his nonpartisan staff to do and walk through this piece of paper that's being handed out. But I also want to talk about the algebra of the formula, members. The algebra of the formula says when there's growth in revenue, we're not going to ask you, and that's just normal growth that everybody else is doing, not extraordinary growth. What we would normally do is we'd say growth above and beyond the statewide average, we'll have you get over some hurdle. Maybe we'll give you 50% of that after you get over the hurdle. What it does is says in normal growth, we'll give you 60% of it back. So it is a huge kind of a different tax proposal that people are hearing about. I know the rest of the committees have not delved into this, and Representative Norton knows I listened to all the hearings, two in the House and one in the Senate, and I heard every word, and I heard exactly how people presented it, and people really have not asked these questions in a public forum yet. So I want to get them on the record. And so before you respond, Representative Norton, just so people understand the things I'm thinking about this, if Mr. Michael could first express the handout that attempts to do some modeling, and then second, talk about the algebra of the formula, because that is what the Tax Committee is going to have to decide, members, if this is going to proceed. So, Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, essentially what the handout describes is an exercise that we went through to try to essentially test the amount of revenue that the proposal in the bill would have captured had it been in effect starting in the late 80s or early 90s in Rochester. In order to do that, what we did was we used some data that the House Research Department compiles to publish a publication that we do annually called Major State Aids and Taxes that essentially uses Department of Revenue data to tabulate by county the amount of the major state taxes and, of course, aids that are derived from and paid to those counties. The bill calls for capturing the growth in two-thirds of the growth in four taxes over a 2011 base, and those are the individual income tax, the general sales tax, corporate franchise tax, and the state commercial industrial property tax, or what we call the state general tax. That last tax is a relatively new tax. It was imposed in 2002, so we omitted it from this exercise. Obviously, the data that we have is for Olmsted County, which is bigger than Rochester, so to allocate it back down to Rochester, what we did on the individual income tax was just to do it based on population shares. That probably understates the amount of income that's attributable to Rochester because the bill's formula provides not just for the residents of Rochester but commuters into Rochester and other employees of the Mayo Clinic that are not located in Rochester. For the sales tax, we allocate it based on the city's sales tax relative to the total Rochester, to the total Olmsted County collections as reported by the Revenue Department. And we have our own, on the corporate franchise tax, we allocate it based on CI property in Olmsted County and Rochester. What the results of those tests show is that for all of the 520 years that we tested, the formula in the bill would have captured roughly $1 billion in state taxes, which should be, I think, more than adequate to pay the bonds that are proposed to be issued under the bill. So that, you know, to the extent that the concern is, will there be enough revenue here to pay those bonds, I think the answer to that is yes. As the chair mentioned, another, what the way the formula works is, again, you take this this base year, and then you look at the growth, the annual growth over that base year, which is fiscal or calendar year 11, and it basically, as the testifiers have described, you take the amount of revenue and you divide it by 1.5. And of course, if you do the algebraic manipulation, what that works out to is you're capturing two-thirds of the growth in revenue. As the chair indicated, one of the sort of the proponents of the bill have argued that this is sort of capturing extraordinary growth. Another way to characterize extraordinary growth would be to say if the revenue grows faster than the rate of growth in overall state revenues from these sources, how much would be captured? And so to test that, we also tested if that had been the formula, how much would have been captured, and that's what the chair indicated. There would be a very much smaller capture. Rather than capturing $1 billion, you would capture only on the order of $40 million or something like that over the 20-year period. Now, this capture is only looking at 20 years, whereas the bill proposes up to a 35-year period, I think, for the bonds to be outstanding. So it understates the revenue potential there. And obviously, this is just looking at what occurred in the past. And as you know, the past is always not a good prediction of what's going to occur in the future. As Yogi Berra used to say, one of my favorite philosophers, you know, prediction is hard, especially about the future. There's no guarantee that this is what's going to happen in the future, and obviously the proponents of the bill are arguing that they're going to make a very large investment and that's going to change the dynamics. So this is really just a historical exercise, but it does show essentially that those two things, that had this been in place, it would have captured enough to pay for the bonds, which is the good news, but that the bad news, I guess, would be that if your benchmark is the rate of growth in the overall state, that then there wasn't as much growth there if that's your measure.
Representative Norton, we're going to go to you and then be done. And members, this is what the Tax Committee works on. It's not feeling good about things. We are going to have to delve into the details on this proposal. Representative Norton.
Well, absolutely we are. And I would say, I think the key phrase was, none of that accounted for the huge investment the Mayo is just committing to make, or the private investment they're going to work on investing in our community too. So an exercise in looking back and looking at normal growth isn't what we're talking about here. We're talking about an extraordinary investment on the part of an industry in my community that could do it someplace else. They've got facilities in Florida and Arizona, and we can invest it in Minnesota and have the gains for the whole state and support Rochester's growth, or we can continue on that little path down there with the black line, which showed Mayo's normal rate of growth, which will benefit the state a little bit, but not moving ahead.
Just so you know, though, the handouts and the bill, and have been repeatedly said, I think people are maybe confusing this, the handouts say that the guarantee is that value capture will only come from DMC initiatives, not normal growth. And that's been said repeatedly. And I think what the work shows is normal growth doesn't get you there. So, in fact, people are delving into normal growth. This isn't extraordinary growth in the revenue. And so that is what this committee is going to have to spend some time on. This is capturing value, folks, from current revenues, not extraordinary revenues. And we can work on that much more. I have a lot of people on the list. Representative Norton, can you come back with everybody? And we'll talk more about
Absolutely. Going
forward. Okay, so thank you, members. Could someone move the minutes quickly?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Davids moves the minutes. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. And I will move House File 1246 down to Representative Davney's committee.
Madam Chair, do you want us to put everything in our folders?
I don't think so. I think we're going to ask them to bring all those handouts back because
okay,
we didn't
you.
Have them. So with that, we're adjourned. Thank you.